That's why sometimes when I see these protesters, Extinction Rebellion, I don't want to rebel against Extinction, Nirvana, cessation, that's what we're on about. Anyway, maybe it's a different meaning. So, today, I want to get a little bit more into the meditation, especially the meditation on the breath, Anapanasati. The first day which I come and teach a retreat, you've got to try and figure out the people who are listening, what is appropriate for them, too deep, too shallow, how much experience you've had, what traditions you've had before. So I'm going to go briefly through the meditation on the breath to show just how it works, and also bring in another few things as well. Now, of course, the meditation on the breath, as I was mentioning in brief yesterday, is not just you sit down and just start watching the breathing, because you find that's very difficult to do, simply because you have been restless, and you don't know really how to watch something as subtle as the breath without interfering with it. And a good example of that is now, this is a common exercise. I want you to be aware of the saliva in your throat and mouth. Okay, now just forget about it. It becomes too difficult to forget about it, because as soon as you're aware of it, you'll find it's not comfortable. You actually, as soon as you're aware of something, you actually disturb it. Which is part and parcel. Any physicists here? Oh no, dear. Well, anyway, you must have heard about Heisenberg. Werner Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. That was actually the basis of it. If you observe something, you disturb it. So the closer you look at it, the least you know exactly where it is and what it's doing. Because the way you disturb the world, whenever you observe it, you can't just, at a distance, observe without interfering. So, you can passive observing, you can not disturb much, but you'll always be disturbing a little bit. So anyway, that means that as soon as we start to watch, say, the saliva, then it becomes uncomfortable. Before, when you weren't watching it, it came in and out quite happily. The breath, as soon as you start watching it, is not comfortable. Other times, you may be listening to a talk, eating your lunch, sleeping, watching a movie or something, and there's no problem at all. Why? It is because whatever we observe, we tend to control. You may not see just how much you control, but there's always some controlling going on there. So, what we do is, before we even start to watch the breath, we learn how to set all the causes and conditions in place. We learn, as it says in the Anapanasati Sutta, we make mindfulness the priority. We get mindfulness in place, first of all. Now, you see later on this afternoon, when I start showing the word of the Buddha, this is, I've been spending a lot of time on this translation to try and get the translation from the Pali much closer to the reality. Remember, those people say the Buddha said this, the Buddha said that. The Buddha never said those things. The Buddha never talked about concentration. He talked about samadhi. He spoke in Pali. The Buddha never talked about mindfulness. He talked about sati and sampajanya. So what we're doing here, we're trying to get these translations far more accurate. And when you get those translations more accurate, you will see that something, one of the first things is to set up sati, and it's a paramukhang. It does not mean in front of your face. It's an idiom, which means put it number one, put it in front, give it priority, the first thing to do when you meditate. It's not watching the tip of the nose. I said, when I was a young man meditating, I suffered from hay fever. If anyone's got any coughs or sneezes, you're not getting a cold. This is hay fever season in this area. And the last time I went out into town, that I saw that the farmers were already making hay. And they just started. And that, when was that? That was, where did I go? Gave a talk somewhere, did something. That was only a few days ago. So by now, once the rain stops and the weather gets very warm, which is supposed to do later on this week, then they'll be making more hay and there'll be some hay fever. So I suffered from hay fever because my father had asthma, so that's what I inherited. And also I meant that some times of the year you'd have a blocked sinuses, which means I could not wash my breath at the tip of the nose. Why? Because there was no breath at the tip of the nose. It was blocked up. So, does that mean you can't meditate? Of course not. There was this one gentleman once. He had sinus cancer. And I would never forget that gentleman, because during the retreat, this was in Sydney, many years ago, the first day at question time in the evening, there were all the questions written by separate people, but the same question. Can you please ask meditators to breathe quietly? Because he was breathing loudly through his mouth. And now when I told everybody his situation with his permission, he said, that gentleman has got this huge tumour in his sinuses. He can't breathe through the nose. Probably never will, because the doctor's only given him a few weeks. He's given up all treatment, nothing is working. Decided to try meditation, see if it would work. Basically nothing to lose. You know, as soon as you explain why people do what they do, then of course there's so much compassion. People say, why didn't you let us know? Sorry for complaining. Breathe as loudly as you like. And that's another interesting side, that sometimes we complain about people getting up in the middle of the night and making a cup of tea for themselves, or snoring, or making too much noise, or doing this and doing that. But if you know where people came from, you say, oh, now please, breathe as loudly as you like. From compassion. So that's what he did, and the story was, after 9 days, the end of the retreat, nothing happened. He was the... But, as nearly always happens, this is so weird that I'm going to give a bit of advice afterwards. This keeps on happening. The last meditation. And in fact, when he came out of his meditation, I was leaving. I was getting into the car to get to the airport, to get me back to Perth. And he ran after me. Stop, stop. And what happened? And he said his last meditation, he heard a popping sound in his nose. And he could breathe through his nose. For about 1 minute, the tumour must have shrunk. And this was not imagination. He knew breath going up in and out of his nose. But just for 1 minute. But that excited him so much. Something had happened. You can't imagine that. It was real. He was breathing through his nose. Of course he was so excited. But you know what the traffic is like in Sydney if you ever go there. And I was going to leave a bit late anyway to try and get to the airport to catch the plane back to Perth. But I said, wow, amazing, just encouraged him. But then afterwards I thought, nah, left it too late. You know, just wait until the very, very last evening, or even the morning when you wake up to do your homework before the exam. And it's leaving a bit late. That's the case, isn't it? But anyway, but the great thing was, about 6 months later, another place in Sydney, giving a talk, and honestly, you would not recognize the fellow from what he was like when he had cancer. And he came up to me, "Do you remember me?" So these days I say, "Ah, yeah, you're the person whose name I keep forgetting." To get out of just of embarrassing people. Yeah, of course I don't know you. Sometimes in Sri Lanka you give these big talks in BMICH, a big convention centre, about 10,000 people. I said, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, I saw you at this, the big convention centre, 10,000 people. Do you remember me?" Come on. You're that person right there in the right corner, sitting in the third aisle at the back over there. "Oh, yeah, that was you." But anyway, they said, "No, I don't remember you." He said, "I was that guy." And he carried on meditating. And of course the cancer shrank. And now full remission. He's got a life. And what he said he's going to spend the rest of his life, however many days he has, just teaching meditation to others. So that's really cool. But anyway, you don't just, for him, if it was breathing through your nose, there's no way you could even start it. It is putting mindfulness as your priority first of all. So what does that mean to learn how to be mindful, to be aware enough to watch something as subtle as the breath without losing any part of the breath? If you've got an ache in your leg or in your bottom, that is going to dominate your breath. If you're tired because you haven't slept enough, you're not going to be able to watch your breath. If you're worried because, I don't know, sometimes we have all these things, you're wondering what your accountant is doing when you're over here. Maybe they are already wiping out all of your assets and savings. Maybe you're wondering what your wife or your husband, your partner is doing while you're here on retreat and they're off in Singapore. I wonder what they're up to. And sometimes we may think all these things because, you know, we haven't got the sense of safety and confidence and ease in the body, which means that the mindfulness will be very difficult to establish in the right manner, which is easy, peaceful, calm mindfulness. Which is one of the reasons why the Buddha say, go to a quiet place. Sure, later on in your life, when you can be a very good meditator, you can meditate anywhere, literally. My record for meditating anywhere was in the center of Perth, Hay Street, Mau, on the cold pavement for 2 hours. I was doing some sort of protest for the treatment of people in Burma. This was many years ago. And because it was the Saffron Revolution or something, I don't know what it was anyway, but it was where many of the students were being killed, and Aung San Suu Kyi was standing up for them. But anyway, so I sat down for them on the cold pavement. In those days, I don't know how many years ago it was, but they had this video game shop called Time Zone. And they were blasting out rock music or all sorts of music while people were playing their video games inside. It was right opposite there. So I had the sound of the traffic, whoosh, whoosh, and all this music and loud noise blasting out. So I thought, this is great. Now to see if I can be mindful of the breath in such an unquiet situation. So, you know, because you've been training long enough, you can do that. It's always never the noise disturbs you. It's you who disturb the noise. But we'll go into that later on, another talk. So, it's much better to find a quiet place. This hall is pretty quiet, but you have to help the quietness. So I think you've already been told, if you bring bags in here, please not those crinkly bags, which make all the noise. Because they can, it's amazing, you put it down, it makes a huge amount of noise. And when you come in, you come in the door there. You don't need to bang it to show you've come in. You can walk so quietly. I don't need to kick people's stools. And when you sit down, you can sit down quietly. Burglars can do that. And they are not highly evolved. So if a burglar can come into a person's house and leave their house, and you don't know they've come or they've gone, then they must be well trained if they can do it. Or what was it? You know, we had a monk here many years ago, a Nepalese man who was a Gurkha. You know, the British army had these really fierce Gurkha soldiers. And he said, you know, their motto was, the only way you know that a Gurkha has come in is when you wake up. You don't hear them coming in or going. The only way you know they've been is you shake your head and it falls off. Those good Gurkha knives, I don't know. But anyway, here's a Gurkha. He was in our monastery as a monk. And so people were a bit scared of him at first until he confessed that he worked, he was in the Gurkha army, but he worked in accounts. Counting the money and paying their salaries. He never actually fought anything. He's a very funny man, very nice man. But anyway, that, with the Gurkhas. So, you should be able to be mindful enough to come in and go out. That's a test of your mindfulness and awareness. And at night time, in your huts, your cottages, the beautiful cottages. But some people are so noisy. They get up in the middle of the night to make themselves a cup of tea. You know what they do? I've got this in here to go. Don't make such a noise making a cup of tea. Even boiling it. Maybe, you know, if you can.
They're not allowed.
They're not allowed. Singaporeans, they may not be allowed, but they still do it. They just hide it. You can put it in the microwave. Microwaves are much better because you don't hear it. Eh? Ding, okay, can we'll do the ding off. Anyway, put it in a thermos or something, whatever. But anyway, try and keep it quiet as best you can. Be like the burglar. So once you do that, that means you start to be mindful and aware. And as you are mindful and aware, when you come in here, you sit down mindfully. So you're actually encouraging the mindfulness during the day. So, making it a priority, it means by the time you start meditating, it's already pretty strong. At first, it seems a little bit false, unnatural, but after a while, you get into it. It's nice, peaceful, learning how to go slowly. And, more than that, to keep that mindfulness there so it can be on something like the breath and not on the body, it's fine to be able to meditate sitting on a chair. You don't need to sit on the ground. In fact, some people say real meditators, they don't use these cushions. You sit straight on the hard floor. You're even better than that. You'll be like some of these Indians who sleep on beds of nails. Come on. Be tough. But no. You try and get reasonably comfortable. There's many types of comfort. There's a comfort when you go to bed at night. You know, you stretch out, mattress or whatever. But obviously you don't bring your mattress in here. be very easy to be very comfortable if you bring your whole bed in here and you lay down in here. Ah, this is easy meditating. But no, that you make a certain type of comfort which you can sustain for many minutes, even hours. In a bed, it's very rare that someone actually stays still in the bed. They toss and turn, move this way and that way. Even beds aren't that comfortable. But to be able to sit comfortably, either on a chair or on a stool, there's a stool over there, they're very comfortable, or just on the ground or whatever, and to make sure that you really are comfortable. Those chairs have been designed. The backrest, you'll notice, about 15 degrees from the vertical. And that's common with many chairs, because over many centuries, despite the law of evolution, those which sell are those which are just inclined backwards. And they're also the most healthy for you, according to physiotherapists. Just leaning back a little bit. Some people like to lean forward, some people like to lean further back. That's fine, but that's just the best posture. And also means, because you're leaning back a little bit, you tend not to nod. Because you're leaning back, and actually to nod takes a little bit of more effort to get to the vertical before you can start falling. So they're very safe. And if anybody still feels that they keep nodding, getting very sleepy when they're on those chairs, you can get some safety belts to put around you so when you start meditating you can't nod. And if that doesn't work, we've got crash helmets. So if you do fall over and hit your head, again you'll be safe. So it's comfortable. But you see already there's some people, those chairs are too high. So what do you do if the chairs are too high? You put cushions underneath your feet, which basically, you know, lessen the length of the legs of the chair. If you're a tall person and your legs are too long, then you put another cushion underneath your bottom, so it raises you. So you really take a lot of care making sure that you are comfortable. And to be able to do that, for many years now, when I've taught meditation and I practice what I teach, I close my eyes, get myself reasonably comfortable, and then I check my posture. How are you sitting? That's not good enough. I become very aware, part by part. It's usually called a body sweeping. And many times people say body sweeping from the hair of the head to the bottom of the feet. I prefer the other way around, simply because being aware of my feet, by the time I get up to my head, that's really important stuff over there. My feet, well, they're okay, they're important, but they haven't got as many vital organs in my feet as they've got in here and in my brain. Well, I'm aware of my feet. Right now, don't look at them, keep looking at me. Do you know where your feet are positioned right now? Can you feel them? Are they comfortable? Can you make them more comfortable? Are they squashed against something? So little by little, you become aware of the feelings in your toes and your soles and the uppers, the heels. You can feel them. They're usually not much of a problem, but I make sure just in case. And then I go up to the ankles, the calves. How are my calves? This is not just to gain information. If I find that they are uncomfortable, I will do something about it. I will move them, adjust them, to get the optimum position. I know I can't get it perfectly comfortable, but I can make a lot of change to make it comfortable enough. Then you get to your knees. The knees which people use, they soon get to pass their use by date and they start to hurt or they start to ache. So experience those sensations in the knees and try and get them as comfortable as you possibly can. within reason. That's why that sometimes, oh, this lady over there has got the bench to sit on. They are very, very comfortable. If you have problems with your knees, problems sitting down on the cushions, because it raises your bottom, you tuck your legs underneath, or in front, she's got there, and it's a Zen stool, they're very, very comfortable. So you may try sitting on those, or on the chair. You can alternate from one to another until you find the most comfortable position for your legs. And even your bottom, so obviously the thighs as well, but the bum, that gets so much pressure on. No wonder it gets sore sometimes, especially if you're wearing loose clothing. You just need a tiny little bit of fold in your robe, and it cuts into the flesh, and after a couple of hours, it becomes quite sore. So you want to make sure that even your bottom, which people don't really pay too much attention to, is comfortable. We're going up to the waist. How is your waist? One of the reasons I always look at the waist is when I first meditate, at that point I usually do a stretch. You see, animals in the forest, they always do stretches. You see the dogs and the cats and even the kangaroos, they have a nice stretch. And of course it releases all these beautiful endorphins, so you do a nice stretch. And then relax. Gets the back into a good position. And then just the shoulders, make sure they're fine. The hands, it doesn't really matter what mudra you have. In other words, where you put your hands, you can put them like this. That's how I was taught in Thailand. Put them like this. Put them like this if you want to. I don't care, as long as you're comfortable. So, put your hands wherever they feel good. Where you can leave them there for a long period of time. Relaxing your shoulders, relaxing your face. The most important part of your posture is this. I was telling about a month ago, going through this old anecdote where, you know, I went to this posh university. I was a bit naive when I went there, so they had all these clubs. Some I wanted to go to, like the Buddhist Society, the Astronomical Society, the Psychic Research Society, going investigating ghosts. Those are the ones I joined up on purpose. But in the college, they had the boat club. You know, when they row in these big boats, you know, the eights in competitions. You know what they did? It was really good marketing, but totally unscrupulous. They'd invite you in for sherry. And the sherry was really good stuff. This was the days when I was drinking as a young student. And I don't know how many glasses of sherry I had, but the next thing I realized I'd signed up for the boat club. And that was really hard work. And getting an oar and pulling it and racing and for long distance. I was never really such a physical person, but then I was racing in these contests, in these eights. And the one thing I got out of that, actually, two things I learned from that. One, don't drink. Because you end up doing things you shouldn't be doing. But number two was that on one of these races, you know, you're trying your very best, but you're getting exhausted. And your energies were disappearing. And then the coach was on the towpath, shouting out through the megaphone, shouting out at me. He said, "You're making an ugly face. Smile." And at first you think, it's okay for you, you're not putting this blooming oar. You know, you're up there just cycling along. It's hard work. That's what I thought. But then at that age, you're always willing to try anything, to experiment. You're very adventurous. So I decided to take his advice. He was a coach. I smiled instead of grimacing. And as soon as you smiled, that oar was much easier to pull. You had more energy. You could actually put more of your force into pulling that oar. It worked. So, is meditation hard? Sometimes if I open my eyes, I'll shout out, say, "You're making an ugly face. Smile while you're meditating." You find you have more energy and you go far deeper. And that also later on in life. Where is it? In Thailand, in the back of these pickup trucks, which the monks had to sit in. The senior monks were up front. They were okay, but the junior monks like me, in the back, they had this metal frame covering the back of the ute, or the pickup truck, the small one. And over that metal frame, the tarpaulin, in case it rained, to keep you dry. But these were old roads, pothole, dirt roads, and they were so bad that whenever the truck driver couldn't sort of avoid them, whenever that truck hit a pothole, the truck went down and I went up, cracking my head against the metal framework over which the tarpaulin was. And that really hurt. As I often say, that many of you, not all of you, have got padding on top of your head called hair. At least something to cushion the blow. Buddhist monks, no padding at all. Crack! Ah! And I thought, why is it the Thai monks never make a face or never grimace or never swear? As for me, you know, because only Western monk there, I thought, okay, I can swear because they won't know what I'm talking about. Swearing in English. I thought you'd get away with it. But no, they knew what I was up to. And anyway, it really hurt me. But then when they hit their heads, you know what they did? They laughed. Crack. Crack. And I thought, this is weird. This is mad. And I said, how can you, they must have hurt them. How can you laugh like that when it hurts so much? So I started using my logic as a scientist. And my first hypothesis was, well, those Thais have been in the back of those trucks much longer than I have. They must have all got brain damage by now. Which was feasible by the... you hit your head. But then these were some very smart monks. They weren't brain damaged. So what else could be the reason why they laugh when they hit their heads? So, what did I do? Another experiment. Let's find out. So I made a resolution. The next time I hit my head hard, I would laugh. I forced myself to laugh, even though it hurt. You know what happened? I didn't have to wait long. Quack! And it hurt much less. It did. It's a wonderful discovery. That's right. And if you don't believe it, you can borrow the gong bonger. Hit somebody on the head. And if they laugh, it doesn't hurt that much. Do you believe me? If you don't, come here. But no, you understand why that works. So the posture of a smile makes the meditation much easier. A little bit of happiness. Where's he gone? Oh, there you've been hiding. Putting the teddy bear on your lap. It's much easier to smile. The meditation is easier. Believe it or not, it is. You know where this started from? I gave a talk in Hong Kong years and years ago, a retreat. And I don't know why this young man did this, but he brought his two teddy bears with him. And then I saw him meditating with his teddy bear and I said, oh, that's a really good idea. And so afterwards, he had the two teddy bears there and people could borrow it only for one day because those teddy bears were so popular. At the end of the retreat, 9-day retreat, he had all these offers for his teddy bears. Thousands of dollars. He said, no, they're my teddy bears. And he actually refused all those offers because people fell in love with the teddy bears and they're such good meditation companions. Never complaining, always there for you, always cuddleable. So these are also part of the posture, if you wish, to get you into a nice deep meditation. So it gets the kindness there so you can really relax. Now, of course, when you get to your brain, Your poor brain is overworked. Sometimes in a body sweeping, I imagine lifting up my head, my skull, taking my brain and putting it aside and giving it a rest. Putting it in bed. Here, brain, you go over here. You have a nice few minutes. You don't have to think while I'm meditating. Take a break. Take a holiday. Because your brain overworks. However, that doesn't work for many people. They think that's stupid. So we do other visualizations in order to let go of most of the work of our brain, which is to do with the past and the future. We relaxed our body. Now, how about relaxing into time and just being here? No past, no future. How do you do that? So one way of doing that is the visualization of the two shopping bags. So the way you do that is you visualize, when you start your meditation, you close your eyes, and you visualize these two shopping bags, one in your left hand, one in your right hand. And if you don't go shopping, suitcases. Because people have had the experiences of holding on to these shopping bags, and they're so heavy. And their arms get aching, and their shoulders start to hurt, because they've been carrying them for too long. So you imagine these two heavy shopping bags. And you look at the shopping bag in your left hand. And you look on the outside. You can see some writing. The name of the shop. Now, I'm not very good at this, because I don't go many shopping, but it's not Gucci, not Versace. What's a common store? Anyway, this one has got the four letters P-A-S-T from the past. That's where it comes from. You've got all these goods from your past you're carrying around with you. You've been carrying around with you for such a long time, no wonder your arm aches and your shoulders hurt. And then you look at the shopping bag in your right hand. That's got more letters on the outside. F-U-T-U-R-E. The future. And that shopping bag is even heavier. With all the worries, anxieties, hopes, dreams, what you expect in the future, that's in the shopping bag in your right hand. That's even heavier. So here you imagine yourselves walking around with these two bags full of the past and the future. So what do? You can't abandon those past and the future because this is your responsibilities. You've got business, you've got family, you've got monasteries, you've got, I don't know what you're supposed to, what you've got. But you imagine the shopping bag in your left hand, the past, how heavy it is. And then you imagine lowering it to the ground. And when it meets the floor, all the weight disappears. And that allows you to uncurl your fingers, move your hand up to your left side, to relax and recuperate. And then you got your shopping bag in your right hand with all the future. You do the same with that. You lower it down to the ground. When it meets the floor, no more burden. It allows you to open up your fingers, move the grasp away, and then put your right hand and arm to your right side, so it too can relax and rest. In that little visualization, you've let go of the past and the future, metaphorically. And you still use this visualization of putting down burdens to realize they're there for you when you finish the meditation. Unfortunately, no one is going to remove those bags away. When you come out of meditation, they'll still be there, but you'll be re-energized, able to carry them with greater ease. And there you look at yourself, you're standing in this amazing place, right between the past and the future. Standing between those two bags, this wonderful place we call now. It's a little exercise to allow yourself to let go of the past and the future, just for the time of the meditation. And also be very careful that during the meditation your hand doesn't just drop down into one of the bags and pick something up. No, leave it down there. It's quite safe. And you're in this moment. And anyway, you start to understand that now is the place your future is being made. Right now is the only time you can do anything for your future. So you know, when you send your mind off into the future, fantasies and dreams, you are actually neglecting your future. You put your attention in the place where the future is made, right now. And also, this moment will become the past later on. And sooner than you know it, you'd have left this retreat, gone back to your homes, and this will be your past. Oh, what a wonderful retreat we had. Wonderful time we had, I hope, over in Jhana Grove. And so you're also not just creating the future, you are creating your past as well, right now. The best thing you could ever do is to make this moment the most beautiful, loving, caring, peaceful moment. And thereby you create past and future, and the only time you could do that. So anyway, that gives the importance of the present moment. And it's only in this present moment that you can even start to think that you're becoming mindful. The future, how can you be mindful about the future? It's just fantasies and projections. What about the past? Are you mindful of the past? No. Do you really know what happened in the past? We keep changing the past. Because when we remember the past, we don't actually remember what happened 5, 6 years ago. We remember the last time we remembered it. And that was the time before we remembered it. So memory of the past is I remember the last time that I remembered, 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 that I remembered. The message keeps going down the track. Like that game we used to play at school. The teacher would line us all up and whisper something to the first kid. Who'd whisper something to the next kid. Whisper it to the next kid. And just to see as it went down the chain of communications, how the message altered. And the classic one which I remember from, it's actually really happened. This was in the British Army during the First World War, where the Major General was, you know, in his lovely office, sipping brandy or something, and he said, pass the order down the chain of command. Send reinforcements, we're going to advance. Reinforcements, we're going to advance. And that was told to the Lieutenant General, who told it to the Brigadier, who told it to the Colonel, who told it to the Major, who told it to the Lieutenant Major, who told it to the Sergeant, who told it to the Corporal, who told it to the private, or something. I have never been in the military, I don't know if that's the right sort of order, but anyway, you get the idea. And by the time it got to the private, you know, the actual soldier, send reinforcements, we're going to advance, was the original command. It became, send 3 and 4 pence, it was the old British money, we're going to a dance. And apparently that actually happened. So that's what happens with your memory. The memory just changes a tiny bit every time. Until by the time after a few years, the memory has got hardly any, not recognizable to what actually happened. Because it all gets altered. So anyway, so you can't trust the past, you can't trust the future. So, the present moment, that's the only place to be mindful. And, the next thing. Remember, you haven't even got to the breath yet. It's coming. The next thing is to stop giving things names. To understand this, and this, I repeat this story because I haven't found anything remotely close to this one in its ability to convey the meaning of silent present moment awareness. And that was the story of Lao Tzu. Would go with a disciple every evening for a walk. But there was a very strict rule. You had to keep silent when walking with the master. So this young man went for a walk with the master for the first time, 2 or 3 hours, and they came to this ridge of the mountains at sunset. It was an incredible sunset. Golds and purples and oranges streaking across the horizon. And the disciple was so in awe of the magnificent natural wonder, he blurted out, "Wow, what an amazing sunset." He'd broken the rule. Now, if Lao Tzu had said, "You've broken the rule," the disciple said, "Well, so have you." Lao Tzu never did things like that. He just turned around silently and walked back to the monastery. And when he was back in the monastery, then he said, "You've broken the rule. Now, when you're on walk with the master, you can't talk. You've broken the rule, so you're banned from going on a walk with me forever." "Forever? It's only one mistake and it's banned for life." So, yeah. And his friend said, "Oh, that's a bit harsh. You know, can't you give him a bit of a break? He's only..." Well, anyway, what's wrong? What's wrong with saying what a beautiful sunset? And that is where Lao Tzu gave the amazing teaching. When that student said, "What a beautiful sunset," he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was watching the words. He wasn't mindful of the sunset. He was mindful of the description, which is one step away, at least, from reality. The commentary and the thing it's describing is very different. And the other story, just to make it a bit more gross, that was very refined. When I went to Dharamsala some years ago, and they wanted some teaching, and I would need to go to the toilet. So I decided to, as they say, we don't say kill two birds with one stone in Buddhism. We say cut two carrots with the same knife. Got to change the metaphors. So I decided I'm going to give them a teaching and also take time out to go to the loo myself, the toilet. So I asked them, "Where's the toilet?" And of course I knew where it was. And then he said, "Over there, there's the door there. It's got toilet, men's toilet there." So I said, "Okay, that's where it is." "Said, yeah, it's over there." I think they knew I was up to something. So I went to the door, and sure enough, it said there, "Male toilet." So I went to urinate on the door. I didn't actually do it. Didn't explain. "So what are you doing?" "Well, he said, male toilet, that's a toilet." "So it says it's got a sign on there, male toilet." "So it's not the door, it's inside." "Why don't you put that on the door then?" "Male toilet inside." You can see the signpost is not the destination. And that's, you might think that's silly, but a lot of times people talk about silence and they only see the sign. They don't experience the silence. So, did you feel the silence? That's what silence is, not the words. So you find that once you experience silence, you're becoming mindful. Having a commentary about life, that's not really being mindful. Ask yourself, "What's this jhana? What do I do to get into jhana? What should I do next? What am I doing wrong? Something's really wrong here. I just want to do something else. What time is lunch? When is this going to talk?" Is that being mindful? Not really the sort of mindfulness you need. It's mindful, you're alive, but the real mindfulness, the stuff that you can start watching the breath. Keep it silent. silent, present moment awareness. And after a while, you find it is effortless. If you put effort into doing this, you find you can't maintain it. It's not natural. You force it. If you learn how to let things go, relax, then you can be mindful. In this moment, silent. And we start that practice by just sitting out on the veranda on a nice warm sunny afternoon and having a cup of tea or coffee or something, just sipping the tea and enjoying its taste, doing it slowly. Watching the trees grow, as I say. I know many of you have been here many times. Have the trees grown in the last time, the years or two since you came here? Yeah, they've grown, but did you see them grow? They must grow sometimes. So if you stay there watching long enough, maybe you can see the trees grow. In other words, an excuse to sit there and do nothing. Because if you say these days, if you're at home meditating and your husband asks you, what are you doing, darling? I say, I'm doing nothing. Oh, great, come and help me. People don't value doing nothing these days. And so if you say that, and I say, darling, I'm doing nothing. Excellent, wonderful, carry on. I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were so busy. Make nothing an important thing to do. So when you start doing nothing, you find it gives you the opportunity just to start relaxing, being in this moment and being silent. And then you find the breath comes to you. Everything else is silent. You can start feeling your breath. How you feel it, where you feel it. Long, short, at least you're aware of your breathing. You know you're breathing in. Naturally, through whatever orifice it needs to come in. Through the nose, through the mouth, through the ear, I don't care where it comes in. You know it's coming in. You know it's going out. Peaceful, beautiful, relaxing. No force. It's just like you lower and rest your attention on the breath. You don't take the breath and say, you're going to stay with me, you're not going to move, I'm going to be with you, breath, okay? You better get that straight from the very beginning. I'm going to breathe in and breathe out, and you're not mindful, it's not going to go anywhere, okay? Poor old teddy breath. Don't traumatize your breath. Sometimes people do that. Sometimes people, they start meditation, and straight away, they don't want it. They go anywhere. They run away, any place but be with the breath. Because they had such bad experiences trying hard to stay with their breath. And the breath always eludes you. Escapes. Yes.
I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I get so relaxed that I fall asleep. So how do you strike the balance?
You don't strike any balance. If you fall asleep, then it means that you should go to bed. That is the place where you're supposed to sleep. You notice here that after a while, maybe even now, you come to this meditation hall and you fall fast asleep when you're meditating. Then you go to your room at night time to have a sleep and you can't fall asleep. Why is it when you want to fall asleep, you stay awake? When you want to stay awake, you fall asleep. What's going on? And the answer is because you are trying to fall asleep when you go to bed. You're trying to stay awake when you're meditating. So just relax. If you're really relaxed, you find you may get dull for a little while, but then your energies will start to return. You're brightened up. The batteries are dead. Almost. But then after a while you start to recharge. When you start to recharge, wow, so easy. Recharge the batteries first of all. You've only just come here. You come from a distance, you're probably tired from the journey. You're also carried with you through the customs a lot of tiredness. what they call sleep deficit. So for the first few days, especially now you've been busy working hard, please have a rest. Any time of the day or night. One lady, she was actually the same retreat as a fellow who had the sinus cancer. And this lady, I really respect her. She got it straight away. She arrived, I think, midnight or 1 a.m. in the morning on a Friday, Saturday morning, late for the retreat. Didn't go through the briefing. And then when she came for a briefing, the first thing on the Saturday morning, the first real day of the retreat, and I told her, you know, what I just told you. Oh, thank you. Because I really feel tired. I've been really working hard. So, after the briefing by me, she went to bed. She got up for lunch. After lunch, she went back to bed again. In the evening, I think she got up for the tea time. Then she went to bed again. And that was basically her routine for the first 3 days. Getting up to eat, then going back to sleep. I think she went for the talk, but after the talk, back to sleep again. And because she was sharing like a room, like a dormitory, you know, she said after 2 or 3 days, she said, all the other girls in the same dormitory, they were looking at me with disgust, as if I was not really making use of the retreat center like I should. I said, her lady, they're not looking at you with disgust, they're looking at you with jealousy. They wish they had the guts to do that, because that's what they really want to do, to take a nice break. And what happened next? After 3 days, because she did it properly, she was tired, so she rested. The next 3 days, you know, she was back, you know, to the schedule other people were doing, roughly. And the last 3 days, you know, she'd already caught up. The last 3 days, she was a star meditator. I was really proud of her. She was really meditating long. There was no tiredness because she caught up on her tiredness. She wasn't trying to prove anything to others. You know, being guilty or ashamed she fell asleep. Now, have you ever seen falling asleep is not against any precept? So, if you need to, and it did, how the caretakers aren't here. Those beds cost a lot of money. So please make use of them. They're not just there to be looked at. So if you need to, that's again why. And one of the reasons why we've got en suites for every meditator here. Your individual rooms. So you don't need to feel guilty or ashamed or whatever. You shouldn't need anyway. If you'd go and have a rest, have a rest. Any time, day or night. Keep it natural. And then you really start to wake up. Okay, so there we go. That's so far. That's Anapanasati part one. Haven't got to the breath yet, but, you know, we're getting there. I think Aiden did ask me to please slow down with my talking. So, well, that's also going to be much slower this afternoon when I... You know, there was this one gentleman who went on one of my retreats. And after he had finished, he was so calmed down, so slow. Everything he did, walking, driving the car, everything was just really slowed down. So on the Monday morning when he went to work, where did he work? At the zoo, in Perth Zoo. So the head keeper, oh, what am I going to do with this guy? He's just so slow. So he told this guy, today I'm going to put you in charge of the tortoise enclosure. That's really smart thinking. Okay, sir, I will guard the tortoise. Tortoises. Okay, off you go. So very slowly, he walked to the tortoise enclosure. It took him about half an hour to get there. At lunchtime, the head keeper decided to check up on him. And sure enough, what did the head keeper find? All the tortoises were gone, and the gate was open. What happened? Well, I opened the gate, and whoosh. So if you slow down so much, tortoises are so fast by comparison. Okay, enough of this. Okay. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.